2012, January 25th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 15, The Chemistry of Life. Well, we're continuing our exploration of life in the universe by trying to start out by understanding what life on Earth is like. That's a big enough job. It's a whole subfield in itself. We're hoping that this is going to give us some idea of what we should be looking for. How do we assess an environment is ripe for life? One of the ways we can look at that is to go into what the chemistry of life is. Last lecture we talked about cells, how they basically are big bags of chemical reactions in one way of looking at them. Today we're going to look at some of those chemical reactions with a mind to looking at what are the elements of life, what are the pieces we need, at least on Earth, to have living systems. So today we're going to be talking about the chemistry responsible for living systems on the Earth. First thing we're going to look at is we're going to introduce the idea today of metabolism. This is the set of chemical processes that are responsible for providing energy or nutrients to cells. This is how cells power themselves chemically. What we're going to see is that all life on Earth, all life, from microscopic bacteria up to us and bigger things, run using something called the ATP cycle, which is how you transport chemical energy within cells in order to enable this chemical metabolism. What you're providing is energy for chemical reactions. For those of you who know something about chemistry, you're basically providing electrons and protons, mostly electrons. You're either taking them away or giving them to be able to power that chemistry. But this chemistry does not occur in the absence of energy. It doesn't run itself, and that's what metabolism is all about. And in fact, metabolism is so important for understanding cell function that we actually can classify living organisms by the type of carbon metabolism that they use inside of themselves. So carbon is going to be the primary chemistry. We are carbon-based life. And it's going to be how you take up and use carbon that determines part of your cell function. There are lots of ways to do that. And so we can describe things as autotrophs and heterotrophs. And we'll see what that definition is here in a second. Furthermore, within autotrophs and heterotrophs, we can make a distinction from where the ultimate energy source comes from, used to power that metabolism. Does it come from sunlight, at which point you might be a photoautotroph or a photoheterotroph? Or does it come from chemicals, either inorganic or organic chemistry, at which point you become a chemoautotroph or a chemoheterotroph? And those two pieces, where you get your energy and what you use as your source of carbon, turns out to determine the metabolism of all living things on Earth. It's surprising. Huge biodiversity, huge range of things on Earth, and yet the metabolism breaks down into four basic groups. And all of those metabolism have at their heart this ATP cycle. Finally, the other piece of information about the metabolism and chemistry of cells is it relies on liquid water. Liquid water will turn out to be the ideal chemical medium, solvent, if you will, for the chemistry of cells. And this gives us some very basic pieces to now understand what the conditions are going to be like for life on Earth. We have one more piece that we're going to explore in tomorrow's lecture, and that's the role of heredity and cell function through RNA and DNA. And finally, we'll then look on Friday at the extremes of life. How hard can we push the environments and still have these different forms of life, not have things so extreme that metabolism or life simply shuts down? So today we're going to look at chemistry of life. I mentioned this before, but it's worth repeating. There are four primary elements that make up all of the chemicals of life. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. Or sometimes we refer to these as the CHON. Occasionally you hear this pronounced Chon group. These four elements are absolutely basic to all forms of life on Earth. We're carbon-based. Carbon chemistry, complex organic chemistry, is the basis of all life molecules, have carbon in chains or cycles in various forms. Water, hydrogen and oxygen, will turn out to be the universal solvent for life on Earth. If there is no water, there is no life. That's a simple absolute we found here on the Earth. Finally, we see that nitrogen begins to play a role. Nitrogen, we saw yesterday, is one of the principal components of amino acids. Amino acids turn out to be the primary pieces that make up proteins. Nitrogen is also important as one of the key components of DNA and RNA in terms of building those molecules. But that's not all we need. There are two other elements that turn out to be extremely important. Not for everything, but in their own way. And they're going to turn out to be phosphorus, which, you know, one of the nice forms of phosphorus is a sort of red oxide you see here, and sulfur. Phosphorus is important because it's actually the backbone, our phosphate sugars of DNA and RNA. The energy cycles we find inside of cells, ATP and ADP, the P there is phosphorus. This is adenosine triphosphate and adenosine diphosphate. So phosphorus turns out to be extremely important both to giving you the backbone of the genetic material, the nucleotides, nucleic acids, maybe a better way of putting it, and is absolutely crucial for the energy provider, the batteries, if you will, of cells that power cell metabolism. Finally, sulfur turns out to come into play. There are two amino acids, in particular cysteine and methionine, that use sulfur. And we're going to find sulfur appears in other ways. What's interesting about this is carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen are very, very abundant. And they're abundant throughout the universe. They're in those sort of top eight or top five elements, top six or seven elements in the universe. Phosphorus and sulfur are relatively rare. Sulfur makes it into the top 10, but phosphorus does not. But without phosphorus, life on this planet would not be possible. This is going to be an important piece. We're going to see this when we talk next week about the possible origins of life on Earth. One of the keys to life getting started was having bioavailable phosphorus. That turns out to be not so easy, as we're going to see. So just kind of keep this in mind. The basic chemistry is not just carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, but also phosphorus and sulfur. I'll show this picture again because these are the 22 amino acids found in all forms of life. They're left-handed amino acids, the exception being glycine, which has no handedness. But I want to point out on this picture, these two elements, levomethionine and levocysteine, use a sulfur up here in this group. These are both fairly common in many different forms of life. And in one case, there's even something rather oddball. This amino acid down here, which has only recently been recognized as useful for life, levoselenocysteine, uses selenium in place of the sulfur in regular cysteine. This one turns out to occur only in a certain very rare type of archaea, a type of creature known as an extremophile. We're going to not meet the particular extremophile there, but selenium is interesting because selenium is actually a metallic poison to most forms of life. Water contaminated with selenium deposits would be toxic to basically plants and animals, but there are certain bacteria archaea that can actually live in the presence of selenium. In fact, the selenium is an essential part of one of the amino acids that makes up one of its structural proteins. So this kind of shows you, again, if you look through all these amino acids, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen appear as the fundamental pieces. The amine group is in nitrogen. The carboxyl is carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. And then carbon and hydrogen fill in the gaps. But occasionally, other elements pop into play. Very rarely. Only in 3 of the 22 amino acids do elements other than carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen come into play. This shows you the centrality of the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen elements, but also the occasional functional usefulness of sulfur and, in this case, a rare point, selenium. Phosphorus, however, is far more important, so much so that some biologists nowadays, instead of talking about carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, expand that to carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus. Phosphorus is extremely important. Here are two examples of elements, key elements of cells that require phosphorus. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, the element of cell heredity in every single form of life on Earth. The backbone of the double helix is a series of these phosphorus and oxygen groups known as phosphates. This is basically a phosphate-based deoxyribose. Ribose is a type of sugar. This is a phosphorylated sugar. And this forms the essential backbone not only of DNA, but also of RNA, as we'll see tomorrow. The other place where phosphorus plays a key role is in the central energy provider of cells, adenosine triphosphate, in which there are 3 phosphate groups hanging off the tail of this otherwise rather nasty-looking thing here called an adenosine. This is going to turn out to be extremely important. No phosphorus, no cell metabolism. Period. It's very, very important. The report you may have seen about a year or so ago about arsenic life. What they were looking at was arsenic turns out to be a chemical replacement, a heavy chemical replacement for phosphorus. It has exactly the same bonding properties as phosphorus, but it's a heavier element. The bonds are weaker. And so one of the things they were looking at was, could you in fact have life live where arsenic was the dominant element, not phosphorus? They should play a similar chemical role, but different because it's a heavier element. And that's one of the reasons why arsenic was looked at. It wasn't just sort of, let's pick some randomly poisonous chemical. There's actually a reason for talking about arsenic, is because of its chemical affinity for the same role as phosphorus. It lives in the same column of the periodic table. What do these chemicals do? How do they actually act to make cells function? We refer to the general run, the suite of chemical reactions that occur within cells that provide either energy or nutrients as metabolism. Metabolism has two fundamental requirements to operate. Number one, you need a source of raw materials, because we're primarily carbon-based, because all of the molecules that are important for life inside of living things, are based on carbon. They're organic compounds. So we've got to have a source of carbon to build up those backbones of the organic chemistry. Furthermore, we need also the oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus, and other elements. We've got to have a way to get those elements into us, carbon with all the rest. But just simply having those elements together is not going to make it, because you need energy in order to power the chemistry. The chemistry requires energy to move those electrons around. There are very few, and we're going to see a couple of them, of chemical reactions that make energy as a consequence of that. Most of the chemistry needed to go on in cells is endothermic. It requires energy to go, rather than being exothermic. These sources of energy can come usually for powering the conversion of carbon, which by itself is not so useful, into useful organic compounds, sugars, proteins, things like that that we need within cells. But you've got to have a source of energy, something to power that chemistry. What those sources of energy are going to turn out to be very important in a second here. So what are the primary chemical energies? What's the way in which we move energy back and forth? I've got an external source of energy. It might be sunlight. It might be chemicals in the environment, organic or inorganic chemicals that react in a way that produce energy. And I've got raw materials. How do I get them together? How do I channel the energy from outside? This comes from the environment to the chemicals within, either absorbed through the environment and transported in the environment some way. How do I transport that energy around among the various pieces of the cell that need that energy? What's interesting is as we've begun to study all forms of living cells on the earth, we find something very interesting. There's one way, and one way only, that cells do this energy transport. The energy source is through a compound which I've already shown you called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. It's used for most cellular functions. ATP powers protein synthesis, which is the primary way of building up the functional components in cells. It's responsible for powering RNA and DNA synthesis. A DNA is not going to replicate itself. That replication process takes energy. The ATP power cycle provides that energy. It provides the electrons that are needed to power that chemistry. Furthermore, ATP actually plays a transport role. ATP, embedded within the membranes of cells, is one of the agencies by which stuff gets from the outside to the inside, that you bring in the raw carbon and other materials that you hand off to the chemical factories, if you will, inside the various proteins and enzymes inside the cell to do their chemical thing. Similarly, ATP is useful for getting rid of the waste products of that chemistry and pushing it outwards. One of those waste products, for example, from photosynthesis is oxygen. You make the oxygen in the cell, but how do you get it out of the cell and ultimately out of the plant into the atmosphere? And the transport agency is powered by ATP. So ATP is the all-purpose battery, the chemical battery of cells. Now, it turns out that ATP itself is produced in cells by a combination of either photosynthesis or respiration, the bringing in of oxygen. So we can do this via various what are referred to as metabolic pathways to building this thing. Furthermore, energy-releasing processes break down ATP. So we have to wait. So ATP is consumed by the energy production, but you also have to have ways of making it. What's interesting is that if you look from every single cell on Earth, this is the way. It's the common energy source to every living thing on Earth. And the common energy source for every piece of the cells, whether they're bacterial cells and prokaryotes, up to complex, liver and skin cells, all use ATP. This, again, is one of these signposts telling us something about the origins of life on Earth. Chemists have come up with other ways to produce chemical cycling. But why is it that all living things only use the ATP cycle? Now, I'm going to show you a complicated diagram. I don't expect you to know this for the test, but I want to illustrate how this works, because this is an important piece of how living things get going. We have to get going these catalytic cycles. We can't just have something where you start it, and it kind of goes for a while and then runs down. It isn't going to be very useful for life. Life has got to be self-propagating. You've got to have repeatable energy cycles, provided you can provide it with outside energy, chemicals from the environment or light, and you have to keep that engine going. It has to actually be a cycle. So we're going to see a lot of cycles in biological systems. So what happens is as follows. The ATP cycle actually relies on two different forms of this molecule, the triphosphate and the diphosphate, three and two phosphate groups in the cycle tied onto this adenosine. We take energy in from the outside. That energy brought in from the outside is, for example, say from photosynthesis, builds up ATP from a combination of ADP that's present in the cell plus phosphates, phosphorus and oxygen compounds. That builds up ATP, but then energy output is if I break this phosphate off the end, that's an energy producing reaction that makes energy go out. It breaks down the ATP into ADP and gives up some energy, which is then used by the protein, the enzyme, the whatever it is that's needing the energy within the cell. So it gives up its energy to the cell surroundings. What it is, it's a donor of electrons, is the powering of chemistry. And then you get it back. And so you actually cycle constantly between ATP and ADP within the cell. You bring energy from the inside up and build up ATP. You charge the battery. And then something that needs energy undergoes a chemical reaction with ATP. You discharge the battery, breaking ATP down into ADP. So you have a charge-recharge cycle going on. Just like in a laptop or any battery-powered device, you got to bring in power from the outside to power it up. It could be a solar cell. It could be plugging it into the wall. I build up the energy inside the chemical battery, and then I draw that power down by turning on my laptop or my iPad or my cell phone, and I discharge. I make a chemical change occur in that battery. Bringing energy from the outside renews the chemical charging, and so forth. So it is very much, we're calling the ATP-ADP cycle, the cell's battery is exactly that. And just like a battery, you need external energy. So one of the key pieces to understanding how ATP cycle powers cell metabolism is understanding what those external sources of energy are like. Now, I got a little ahead of myself in some of my introductory comments, but I'm going to repeat this again. One of the most surprising things we've learned over the last few years of studying cell function is that every single cell on Earth uses ATP. In fact, it's the only thing they use. Everything we've seen, eukarya, bacteria, archaea, among this is a different variation on the tree of life, uses this. People have figured out there are other alternative cycles that can work in nature, but they're not used. And we actually don't know why they're not used. The only explanation really is that it probably has something to do with having a common ancestor that used ATP, and we know that phosphorus chemistry is very energetic. Right, you can make these other cycles, but they may take a lot more energy up. They're not very efficient. Maybe they don't have high yields. Or maybe the chemical precursors behind them to build up the chemical, I'll use the word machinery because it's an evocative vision, but it's not really a machine, is difficult. Maybe it's hard to get into that state. But once you got into bioavailable phosphorus in the environment, originally in the oceans, because all life arose originally as marine life in the oceans, once you opened up that channel to use phosphorus-based chemistry as the way to make energy, life took over, evolution took over, natural selection took over, and it carried it through various places. It was a useful solution, and it stayed that way. What's interesting is from the point of view of looking at truly alien life, this might give us a way to recognize truly alien life. Maybe in an alien biosphere around some other star, something other than one of these other cycles is used. So if truly alien life somehow landed on Earth, we'd recognize it because the fundamental chemistry of its cell metabolism might be different from every other living thing on Earth. It might look superficially like a bacterium. When you look at its biochemical function, it's different. That's maybe how we really define alien. Or it might be that there's a reason why ATP is more efficient than any other thing, and other planets, convergent evolution as we call it, found that same solution to the problem of powering metabolism. We don't know, but we're going to keep this one in the back of our heads when we start talking about the possibilities of life elsewhere. It's a clue, the fact that there isn't, oh, well, bacteria use one thing, plants use one thing, animals use another. When you strip down the superficial differences of configuration, how I arrange the cells into structures, underlying is a phenomenal amount of commonality. We have billions upon billions of different forms of life through human history. But at their very base, they're nearly all the same in their fundamental operation. That's a fascinating insight. It's telling us something very important. All right, so we got a battery, we got an ATP cycle. We have to have some raw materials. We need carbon. We eat carbon. We need to bring carbon in to get there, to power things up. So we need two things to understand the differences of organisms by their metabolism. We need a source of carbon, and we need a source of energy. Carbon are the building blocks. ATP power cycle powers the chemistry to build those building blocks into proteins and other good stuff. And we need a source of energy. The battery's got to be recharged. The ATP cycle's got to be reset to build up ATP from the relatively chemically inert ADP. The sources of carbon, there are two of these. We define a creature as an autotroph, literally a self-feeder. So auto meaning self or same, means I get my carbon from carbon dioxide. This is very important because carbon dioxide is the most common form of carbon in the biosphere. It's in the atmosphere. A heterotroph, other feed, is you get your carbon not directly from CO2, but from something else that ate the CO2 and built organics, and then you eat the organics. We are heterotrophs. We eat organic compounds. Whenever you hear people talk about organic food, I always get a chuckle because they think, what's inorganic food? Eating plastic? No, wait, plastics are organic. That doesn't matter either. Eating metal, eating silica sand, those are not inorganic compounds. You can't eat those. Why? Well, they pass through your body or they lodge through. Why? There's no carbon. Your body doesn't know what the hell to do with it. Unfortunately, sometimes the heavy metals you eat, the body does know what to do with it, and it's the wrong thing, and then you get metal poisoning. So we eat other carbon things, plants, animals, carbon sources. But some of those carbon sources, like plants, get their carbon from CO2. They breathe it in through the air and build up the sugars. So heterotrophs, we feed on other things. Autotrophs feed themselves from the environment, from the air, from the water. It doesn't have to be carbon dioxide in the air. It could be carbon dioxide gas dissolved in the water. Now, we need a source of energy. There's two obvious sources of energy in our environment. Heat is a source of energy. We can get photosynthesis as energy comes from sunlight. Photons come in, they give up their power to the cell, and they actually cause the cell to do something energetically. Photosynthesis. Chemosynthesis, the other synthesis you don't normally hear about, is energy from inorganic oxidation. Here's where metals become important. Hydrogen can become an inorganic oxidant. Iron and sulfur, manganese, magnesium. All of those funky inorganic compounds, which may or may not be useful, iron, sulfur, and others are, because they can become a source of electrons, a source of oxidation. So we can use metallic chemistry as a way of getting energy from our surroundings through this process called chemosynthesis. Photosynthesis is pretty common. Chemosynthesis, we use chemosynthesis as part of our metabolism. Other creatures use chemosynthesis. So there are a number of different, there are in fact four different possibilities. You can have photoautotrophs that use sunlight plus carbon from the environment, or chemoautotrophs, chemical inorganic oxidation plus feeding from the environment. Similarly, you can have photoheterotrophs, things that get their carbon from eating other things but get their energy from sunlight, and chemoheterotrophs are the four possible combinations. The answers are, where do you get your carbon and where do you get your energy? What are the sources of energy that you tap? Let's walk through some of these things. Let's start with heterotrophs. Heterotrophs get their carbon by eating organic compounds. A chemoheterotroph gets energy from the from organic and inorganic compounds in the environment, and we take in the carbon by eating other complex carbons. So, for example, I guess this is a form of chemoheterotrophy going on here. Animals, fungi, and even a few bacteria are examples of chemoheterotrophs. All animal life is a chemoheterotroph of some kind. All animals eat other things to bring in their carbon, and then use chemical reactions, mostly inorganic chemicals with inorganic oxidation, and occasionally organic oxidation within the body, so there are always exceptions, to get their power. A photoheterotroph would get its energy from sunlight, but it would consume its carbon by consuming other things. These are actually really, really rare. Right? Chemoheterotrophy, this room's full of chemoheterotrophs. But photoheterotrophs, for a long time, people thought they didn't even exist. That was an impossible channel. In fact, there turned out to be a group of heliobacteria. It's got a nifty name. They're called chloroflexes, that are extremely rare. They, in fact, will dissolve carbon from their surroundings. Basically, they'll go in and attack flesh or something like that, but use sunlight to power the subsequent chemistry to take up that carbon and turn it into useful compounds. It's kind of a really weird configuration, but they do exist, but they're very, very rare. So I'll mention them in passing, but they're very, very rare. Autotrophs get their carbon dioxide from the environment. They get it from carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide can be the CO2 in the air we breathe, or that these creatures breathe, or it can be CO2 dissolved into water. Remember, most of the carbon dioxide on this planet is not in the atmosphere, it's dissolved in the oceans. And in the earlier day, it's also in rocks too, but it's primarily dissolved in the oceans. Now, you've got a source of carbon, you either get it from ocean water, or you get it from the air, from carbon dioxide, and then you need energy to do something with it. A photoautotroph uses sunlight as the power source. For example, all plants, all green plants on the earth, all photosynthetic bacteria are photoautotrophs. They take in carbon dioxide, plants from the air, bacteria, for example, from dissolved carbon dioxide in water, and then use sunlight to convert the carbon to power the chemistry that converts that carbon dioxide in water into sugars and other useful chemicals. There are also chemoautotrophs. They get their carbon dioxide, for example, from dissolved carbon dioxide in water, but they use oxidation of inorganic chemicals, particular iron, sulfur, and other things, sometimes organics, like ammonia is not inorganic, that's NH3. So they can use either single elements or even molecules which are inorganic molecules like ammonia, that's nitrogen and three hydrogens, as the power source to get the electrons to power their chemistry. The examples of this are very interesting. Some bacteria and nearly all of the archaea, the ancient quasi-bacteria that we find still here, evolved from some common ancestor of all of life, get their energy through chemoautotrophy. This is an important clue as to the possible origin of life. Chemoautotrophs, because you have abundant carbon dioxide dissolved in ocean water, and you have energy from metallic, inorganic, or perhaps very primitive organic compounds, are very prevalent on the early Earth. This may have been the first form of life, may have been chemoautotrophy. And other forms, photosynthetic and photoautotrophy, and later, with more complex things, chemoheterotrophy came later. So we're maybe seeing the signposts of the first forms of life on Earth. The easiest bioavailable carbon dioxides dissolve in water, but you need abundant inorganics to help power oxidation, which is part of where you get your electrons for the chemistry. Now, of all these various cycles, one of which is very important to Earth now in life today, and that's photosynthesis. And I want to say just a little bit about how photosynthesis works. Photosynthesis in photoautotrophs is basically the conversion of carbon dioxide and water into sugars and oxygen, useful stuff. Oxygen is basically expelled as a waste product, which is good for the plant because it gets rid of the oxygen, which is oxidation is kind of does bad things to chemistry, at least in plant cells. But oxygen is good because it oxygenates our atmosphere and makes us possible, among other things. The cycle that's used is something called the Calvin cycle. I'm not going to go through this. It's a really complicated cycle. You take sunlight and water in. ATP plays a role. There's some other stuff called NADPH plays a role in here. carbon dioxide is brought in the Kelvin cycle. You bump sugars out the back. ADP, the other half of the ADP, ATP cycle, comes popping out the back, plus a phosphate. And, of course, you end up with a charged NADP+. That NADP+ is telling you there's your electron that's helping power the chemistry. So you bring carbon dioxide and water together. ATP plays its role. It's the mediator. It's the one that makes certain that energy and electrons get passed around and ADP back, and that closes the cycle. So the Kelvin cycle has an ATP cycle rolling inside of it. And what you get is there are particular groups of cells which are use sunlight. When sunlight hits them, they're actually an interesting little thing. There's a little ring of nitrogens. It has a little magnesium sitting in the middle of it. That's part of a long chain of thing called chlorophyll A. There's a big tail on it. The electron hits the magnesium nitrogen active group, does its thing, an electron comes out, and the long tail transports the electron out to the back. It's a wicked cool little molecule called chlorophyll A. I won't show you a picture of it. I'll throw a little tidbit out at you. Take that magnesium in the middle of that little nitrogen group there, take it out and put an iron in place and leave the rest of the structure completely alone. What's that? Heme B, functional group of hemoglobin, the oxygen transporter in blood. Two identical molecules, I simply change a magnesium for an iron. Can you say common ancestry, boys and girls? Really important. Take two completely different functions, and yet they're identical for one element. And their role is to move electrons around, either take them in or push them out. Wow. This is why this stuff is so cool. If I'd known this stuff 30 years ago, I probably wouldn't be an astronomer, I'd be a biologist. Anyway, chemosynthesis turns out to be pretty important to us. So photosynthesis, we all kind of have a kind of a conceptual feel for, but chemosynthesis is the other synthesis. It's used in chemoautotrophs. It's the conversion of carbon dioxide into organics by using oxidation of inorganic compounds or methane. Methane is an organic, so it's kind of one of the exceptions to the rule. Okay. An extremely diverse group of organisms uses chemosynthesis to get its energy. Mostly bacteria and archaea. No more complex multicellular or eukaryotic forms of life that we know of use chemosynthesis. So it's only in these very, very simple prokaryotic, and some of them are very ancient prokaryotes. A lot of these are not found on the surface. They're found in the deep ocean near undersea volcanic vents. What's the big deal about the undersea volcanic vents? Well, number one, the deep in the ocean, they provide warmth. Warmth is good for chemistry. Two, there's a lot of crud coming up from deep inside the crust. What's that crud got? It's rich in sulfur, hydrogen sulfide, iron. Those are the pieces, the inorganics you use as your source of oxidation. The carbon dioxide is dissolved into the seawater. So you use dissolved water, dissolved carbon dioxide, heat, which helps you out a little bit, but iron, sulfur, magnesium, all the metals coming up from these deep sea vents give you the chemical precursors that you need to power chemosynthesis. Those cycles are so complex, I'm not even going to show them to you. They're really ugly. But what this means is I have a place where life can form deep in the ocean vents, deep inside the oceans of the Earth. The reason why these are interesting, and we're going to say some more about these particular creatures on Friday when we look at the extremes of life, is these may be of what the first forms of life on this planet look like. A source of energy, a source of inorganics for oxidation, and a ready source of dissolved carbon dioxide. You got to have much more complex carbon before you get a heterotroph. So chemoautotrophs were probably the first form of life on this planet. Photosynthesis, making oxygen, that's a much more complex bit of chemistry. There's an awful lot going in on there. But these very, very simple creatures are able to use that. So it's an important clue as to what's going on. Questions about that before we go on? You'll notice one of your homework problems has you distinguishing various types of chemo, photo, auto, heterotrophs in particular creatures. I'll let you think about that a little bit. A common denominator of all of these discussions, let's take a deep breath now, take gears a little bit. A common denominator of all of this discussion of chemistry has been water. Water this, water that, dissolves in water, CO2 dissolves in water. Water is a transport mechanism. The other thing you need for chemistry is you're not going to get a whole lot of chemistry going on a tabletop. You don't get, if you just put a bunch of chemicals, pile up a bunch of powdered chemicals, they don't do much very often. In order to get chemistry to go, you need some way to transport the elements around. You need to be able to carry off waste products and carry in pieces it needs to drive those reactions. In other words, the medium needs to be fluid. Things need to be able to move around fairly freely, and fluids are the best way to do that. Gas phase chemistry does occur. Occurs all the time. But it's very inefficient because the atoms are moving really fast. They don't spend a lot of time near each other. Liquids are between us. Solids are not so good because everything's locked in a matrix. You can't get from over here to over here through a solid because you're locked in the whole crystalline lattice thing. So fluids are nice. They slow things down. They lower the energy a little bit or maybe help give you a medium to carry things around. They act, chemically speaking, we refer to that ability of fluids to take up and allow chemicals to move freely through them as solvent. They dissolve, chemicals dissolve into water. Turns out that liquids, and water in particular, is a medium for chemical reactions. It's actually really ideal. You need something to go in. So there's some solvent. It could be water. We actually can do this in ammonia, which can be a liquid in many temperature zones. Maybe even liquid methane. There are lots of liquids that could do this. But what are the properties that liquid needs? Well, first of all, you need a way to a medium uses carries nutrients in, carries the waste products away. You don't want a chemical reaction going on and the waste products building up choke off that reaction. You want to carry those wastes away. Liquids have another nice property. They help maintain thermal regulation. If your reaction makes a bunch of heat, that heat could actually heat you up so much locally that it actually begins to break up the chemical reaction. You need waste heat is also one of the waste products. And liquids are really nice because liquids have something called a high heat capacity. You could pump a lot of energy into them, and it just spreads that energy out among all the different molecules that make up the liquid. Similarly, liquids provide a form of protection. If you've got a chemical reaction that wants to occur and sunlight's a problem, having it occur deep underwater is a good thing because sunlight only penetrates very little into the surface of the water. Or it could provide protection from the outside. Maybe certain gases are a problem in the presence, or dryness, if you will, of the thing. The liquid allows you to encapsulate that. It forms a I'm here as opposed to outside. Liquids have a nice sort of outer interface between gas and liquid, or liquid and solid. So this liquid medium, this solvent, has a lot of properties it needs. And if you look around at the possible solvents, water, chemically speaking, is about as ideal as it gets. Why? Why is water so good? I can imagine ammonia chemistry, and we'll look at that later in the class. Here are some of the reasons. Why is water such a cool substance? Number one is it's abundant. It's made out of hydrogen and oxygen. Hydrogen and oxygen are in the top six, in fact, the top four elements in the universe. Hydrogen, helium, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen. So we make it out of stuff that's really abundant. There's lots and lots of it around. It has a very nice property that it is liquid at normal pressures like it around here between 0 and 100 degrees Celsius. That's a big range of temperature, and it turns out to be ideal for a lot of chemical reactions. The thermal energy from 0 to 100 degrees Celsius is about the bond energy in a lot of organic chemicals. If you're too hot, the thermal energy is big enough to break your bonds. Not a good place to be if you form a chemical and immediately break it apart. Similarly, if you're too cold, you form a bond and you never break them, so you can't form and exchange bonds to have chemistry go on. So it kind of lives in a thermal sweet spot for this. Water is a really good solvent. Most organic chemicals and a lot of inorganics readily dissolve in water. It has a huge heat capacity. Watch how long it takes to get water boiling to make a cup of tea or a pot of pasta. It takes you a while. You've got to pump a lot of heat into it because it's got a big heat capacity. So you get chemical reactions producing heat. It has the capacity to soak up that waste heat and spread it out. So it's a very good thermal properties of the solvent. It has another interesting property, which is going to seem odd for us here. It's less dense when it freezes. What's that all about? Have an ocean. Start freezing the ocean. You make ice, what happens to the ice? If the ice is less dense than liquid water, it floats to the top. That allows you to have a very an environment where things are frozen. All the ice goes to the top, but stays liquid below. It sort of floats against gravity. It's kind of self-protecting. It keeps you from freezing all the way to the floor. Imagine if you froze something and the ice was denser than water, denser than the liquid, it would sink to the bottom, the top would be liquid, it would freeze, sink to the bottom, and just like building, it's like a Tetris game. Pretty soon, you're solid from the bottom to the top. So making an ocean out of a liquid that froze denser so it sank, you could freeze the sucker solid to the floor. You freeze water, you make a cap. That has a more of a global property, but it actually would be useful when looking at why life was able to survive snowball Earth. It froze only the top kilometer, but the oceans go down 10 kilometers. There's still liquid water. And it has a high surface tension. High surface tension means it's hard to get from the inside to the outside and vice versa. It forms a protection layer. So water's got some absolutely marvelous properties. It is the universal solvent of life. We're going to come back to this theme later in the class when we start looking at alternative environments and alternative chemistries for life. But we've got to keep this in mind. Water in its liquid form seems to be absolutely essential for life. We're going to test that on Friday's lecture. Okay. So what's our bottom line here? We've seen that cell metabolism and all things on Earth are run by the ADP-ADP cycle. It needs to have some kind of solvent. It needs a source of energy, either photoenergy, light energy, or chemical energy, which helps fuel those chemical reactions. You need a relatively warm environment that contains liquid water, because liquid water is the primary medium in which chemical reactions occur for the reasons we just reviewed. Its properties are absolutely wonderful as the solvent of chemical reactions. You have a lot of complex chemistry that has to occur, primarily carbon chemistry, but maybe not. Maybe there are other forms of chemistry that can lead to life. If not on Earth, maybe somewhere else. But you have very complex chemistry. You've got to be able to make copies of yourself, encode and build that information out somewhere. And you need a source of raw materials. You need carbon and other heavy elements. So this tells you what the environment's going to look like for life, not only on Earth, but on other planets. We need to find places that have sources of energy, sunlight, perhaps, or starlight, if it's another star, and chemicals, metals, that are capable of providing inorganic oxidation. You need an environment that is warm enough and moist enough to have liquid water, abundant. We need to have primarily carbon chemistry. We need to have an environment that is conducive to complex chemistry. Not so hot that complex chemicals don't get broken apart by the heat. Not so cold that you can't build up the complex chemicals at all, or that the complex chemicals freeze somehow. And I need to have carbon and other heavy elements in a bio-accessible means. It doesn't matter if I've got them. I've got to have them accessible. They've got to be in contact with water and dissolvable in water. So looking at the requirements of metabolism and cell chemistry has actually given us a laundry list of the requirements for life as we understand it on Earth, and some hints as to maybe some non-Earth life that we might want to consider at a future time. Any questions? Okay, Henry, I want you. Okay, in that case...